Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Hey, happy Wednesday, everybody. Welcome to the Voice of Indie podcast. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and this is show number 29, getting closer to show number 30. And with me, as usual, is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. How you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing great, trying to stay warm down here, even in Alabama, where we drop down into the 20s. I drove into Huntsville this afternoon and all those places where they blast out the mountains to build a road through there, and normally you see water seeping out of the rocks. Now they're all these beautiful ice waterfalls. It's just really, really cool. I wanted to pull over and take some pictures, but that whole idea of not getting run over kind of won out.
Yeah, I woke up to 13 below zero here in Michigan, so... Yeah, that's I'm used to seeing the ice everywhere, you know, on the road, on the sidewalks, on the side of the car.
Yeah. Okay, listeners, we've got another exciting show for you with a great guest today, and we're looking for people to call in with comments, questions, advertisements, whatever you want. That number is 516-453-9902. For those of you who just got caught unawares, I'll say it again, 516-453-9902. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, and you can also, if you don't want to use the telephone, you can join the conversation on Twitter. Just go to Twitter and use the hashtag Fresh Ink Group, hashtag Fresh Ink Group in your tweet, and we will definitely see it. So if you have a question or a comment for tonight's guest, go ahead and throw that in there, hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
And we want to remind you, too, that after the show is over, we archive this show in five places. I'll tell you the first four, which are at freshinkgroup.com on the podcast tab. In this case, it'll probably be a few days before we get it on there because we made a mirror of the website and we're having some upgrades done right now. So there's no point in putting something new on there because they're not in the copy that we made. But the podcast will be up fairly quickly at stephengees.com. beamweeks.com, and here's the important place, on our YouTube channel. Go to YouTube, search Fresh Ink Group, go to the Fresh Ink Group channel. While you're there, make sure you subscribe and hit that little thumbs up every time you look at one of our videos. But you'll find all of our podcasts over there as well. Plus, where else, Beam?
And we are also now on Spotify. So just go over to Spotify, type in Voice of Indie, and we will pop up, and you'll have every episode we've ever done on the Voice of Indie podcast is right there for you to choose the one you want to listen to or listen to them all.
Now, before we get to today's guest, I want to note the passing of an important person, one of the greatest musicians of our time, and a person who's always been important to me as one of my heroes because I'm a keyboard player from way back. And I discovered this guy when I was a teenager and have followed his career all of the rest of my life and sadly for all of the rest of his. And it's Chick Corea, the great jazz fusion pioneer, keyboard player, Chick Corea, who has played with every great jazz musician there is, all the way back to he even played on Miles Davis's Bitches Brew, and I believe another one of his albums. But Chick Corea is just one of the all-time great who has really meant a lot to me, has influenced my music tastes and my music style when I'm composing and playing music. When I learned about it, I went over and had a look, and I noticed, like, on Chick Corea's Facebook page, every great musician there is has left a note on there. But at the chickcorea.com website, on the home page, they announced his passing, and they posted a message that Chick wrote just before he died. Apparently, he learned just in recent weeks that he had a rare form of cancer and did not know he had it, and he only had a couple weeks left once he discovered it. But on his website, he posted this message. I want to thank all of those along my journey who have helped keep the music fires burning bright. It is my hope that those who have an inkling to play, write, perform, or otherwise do so. If not for yourself, then for the rest of us. It's not only that the world needs more artists, it's also just a lot of fun. And to my amazing musician friends who have been like family to me as long as I've known you, it has been a blessing and an honor learning from and playing with all of you. My mission has always been to bring the joy of creating anywhere I could, and to have done so with all the artists that I admire so dearly, this has been the richness of my life. Now, I had the opportunity to meet Chick Corea a few times. I got to have dinner with him one time, and he was a generous man. And whoever he was with was the most important person in the room. He was always interested in what you'd have to say. He would stick around after concerts and talk to people who wanted to stay a little after the show. He's just a great man, a great musician, somebody I've long admired, and I hate to see him go.
Yeah, and I just want to throw my own little experience in here. You and I, Stephen, saw him in concert together here at the 2018 Detroit Jazz Festival. He was there for a few nights, and we saw the acoustic band, and just a fantastic performance. I mean, just a fantastic performance. And we were supposed to see him the following night with the electric band, but the park where it was at, a tornado was coming through the area. So they cleared out the park, and we didn't get to see him with the electric band, but I can tell you, I am thankful that I was able to see that performance of the acoustic band that night in Detroit. And so that's another one that I've seen now that's gone, and that's a long list that's kind of growing as the years pass. But like I said, I'm glad I got to see Chick in concert.
Yeah, that Detroit Jazz Festival, the third night, which you were not able to attend, I did go back and saw Chick Corea perform with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, which is just emblematic of Chick. He sometimes had as many as four or five bands going simultaneously and would tour with them at the same time. I had times when, like, he would come to Detroit with one band, I'd get to see him, and then 3 days later, I'd see him somewhere in the area with a different band, and then a couple days after that, with a third band, or maybe as a duet with somebody like Gary Burton, or he used to duet with Herbie Hancock sometimes. So the fact that the last time I got to see him was with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra really says a lot about the range and depth of the kind of music he played. And my last final sad note on that is that Chick Corea announced about 2 months ago that he was going to do two shows in Florida. Now, he lived in Clearwater, Florida, just literally walking distance from where one of my best friends lives down there. And he announced these two shows because he just wanted to get his, you know, keep his chops up, just get in front of an audience and do something, even if it was people seated every third row and six seats apart and all that, in order to make it happen during a pandemic. And I flew down there to see the show, and the day before the show, they had to cancel it. And I suspect that that was probably about the time that he was noticing his health problems. So that would have been his last concerts ever, and I have a ticket for his last show, but didn't get to see it. So that's just kind of a sad end.
You know, perhaps a couple weeks down the road, we do a tribute show to him or something on the air.
Yeah, that would be nice.
We can talk about putting something like that together. But tonight we have a very special guest. With us is author G.M. Lupo. G.M. Lupo is a native of Atlanta, where he has always had a dysfunctional relationship with his hometown. He currently resides in Middle Georgia, near where his Lupo ancestors lived nearly 200 years ago. His most recent published work is a story collection, Reconstruction, which came out in 2020. Part of his series of Atlanta stories, which includes Fables of the New South, which came out in 2017. Along with his novel, Rebecca, too, in 2018, these constitute his expanded universe of fictional Atlanta. He has also released a collection of essays, poetry, and stories entitled Words, 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 which came out last year in 2020. He was the winner of the 2017 Essential Theater Playwriting Award for his full-length play, Another Mother, which had its world premiere in his home neighborhood of the West End in 2017, in the building that once housed the library where he'd learned to read as a child at school. He is a member of the Dramatists Guild, Merely Writers, and the Independent Book Publishers Association. And with that, welcome to the show, GM Lupo. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Well, did I miss anything in that bio? Is there anything you would like to add to it?
The most recent works are what you mentioned were my most recent works. I have some other books that currently are out of print. Have a longer work called The Long Timers that I came out with in 2007. And it was through a publisher that I didn't really like that much, and they gave me the opportunity to get the rights back. So I got it back, got the rights back, and published it under two separate titles. I planned to turn it into a trilogy, and I didn't quite get that far. And that was called The Long Timers. And then the two volumes that I came out with were A Tale of Two Sisters and Crazy Like the Foxes. Those are still available in Kindle format, but my writing style has evolved considerably since I wrote those, and I'm wanting to go back and do some work on them and revise them, and maybe actually come out with the third and maybe even fourth volume on that one book. The original Long Timers was about 640 pages, and
wow.
And I've been breaking it up into smaller chunks since then. And in the meantime, my writing style has evolved, and I'm really happy with the direction my writing's going now. So I kind of like to take another crack at the book now, as opposed to what I came up with quite a few years ago.
So, Matt, where are you?
Geographically, you mean? Or
where are you?
Oh, okay. I am in about halfway between Warner Robins, Georgia, and Perry, Georgia. I am approximately 120 miles south of Atlanta, and I'm just below Macon. I'm about maybe 30 minutes from Macon here. It's right along I-75. I'm about maybe 2 miles from I-75 right now.
And, I know where that's at.
Yeah,
I spent about 2 months in Macon, Georgia, back in the late 1980s. I had a girlfriend, and her father's family lived in Macon, and we ended up spending some time there and thought about relocating to there, but then ended up going elsewhere.
Yeah, there it's an interesting city. Before I moved down here, I had never actually been to Macon, even though I lived, you know, in Atlanta all my life. And so I've been going to theater. Well, when we were still able to, I was going to shows and driving into Macon to go to shows and stopping off at a bar while I was there and getting to know that city. And hopefully I'll be able to get back to doing that again in the not too distant future. So.
So is your family from Georgia?
Yes. Both sides of my family have been in Georgia for pretty much 200 years, but my mother was actually born in West Virginia. Her father left Georgia, went up and met my grandmother, had my mother, and then they broke up, and she came down here to be with him. So that's how I came about. But yeah, both sides of my family go back in Georgia at least 200 years. My mother's family was here approximately in the 1790s, and my father's family was here around 1800. And then beyond that, they go back as far as the early 1600s in Virginia and then the Carolinas.
And,
yeah, those are deep roots.
You're related to the Tudors?
No, I have my ancestors, my Lupo ancestors were musicians who served in the under Henry VIII and Elizabeth I and into the reign of James I.
Wow, that's a pedigree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're listening to GM Lupo, playwright, author, photographer, Georgia native, raconteur, whatever you want to call him. You can probably get away with it. And we're going to take a quick break, listen to a commercial, and then come back and see what's happening on Twitter and see if we can get some phone calls going.
And we do have a phone call, so we'll jump into that as soon as we come back.
All right. Writers, got a short story looking for a prestigious anthology that will showcase your work alongside other top authors? Or maybe you've experienced a moment worth sharing, perhaps with some poignant meaning we could all appreciate? Fresh Ink Group is accepting submissions for our second and third volumes of the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase to be released worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. There are no fees to enter. Winners are not only published, but are eligible to become members of Fresh Ink Group with your own dashboard in the FreshInkGroup.com website. Head on over to FreshInkGroup.com's contest tab to learn more. Then grease up the old Underwood and get those shorts down on parchment so you can get your entries in sooner than later. And you readers, discover 49 wondrous tales already released in the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Showcase number 1, available in all formats worldwide.
All
right. Now, before you take the call, Beam, we do have a quickie from Verwayne Greenhoe over on Twitter. He says, okay. Yep, we had 14 last night. And here is a shot of Tequamanon Falls 2 days back. And he's got a beautiful picture here of the falls looking frozen. And just a little note of shameless promotion here. If you buy my short story collection, Comes This Time to Float, the title story, Comes This Time to Float, has a gorgeous picture of Tequamanon Falls that was taken by photographer Scott Walson. Scott Watson. Boy, I'm stumbling all over my tongue today.
Put down that tequila.
Yeah.
All right. Now let's go ahead and take this call here. Hello, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Are
Hello, caller.
Me?
Yeah,
me?
I know that voice, Dr. Helen.
I know that voice.
It is I, Helen, the writer.
Nice.
Okay.
Calling
Dr.
to
Helen.
Support other fig writers.
All right. So,
I would like
what do you
ask Mr. Lupo a question?
Okay.
Oh, did you want to say something, Beam?
No, I was going to say, what do you have for us tonight? That's all I was going to say.
The
Go
question
ahead, Helen.
I have for Mr. Lupo is, How do your Georgia roots influence your fiction writing?
My Georgia roots are actually informing quite a bit of my writing now. My most recent work, starting with Fables of the New South and Rebecca mm-hmm. 2, those are both set in Atlanta. And in fact, Fables of the New South
and
Atlanta
Reconstruction. Is that in that short story collection?
Yes, that is also set in Atlanta. Reconstruction is a continuation of the stories from Fables of the New South. And those are set in Atlanta, and they're set in what I call my expanded universe of fictional Atlanta. It's people that don't necessarily actually exist, but people that you'll probably recognize, certain types. And it is informed by my life growing up in Atlanta and in Georgia. And I set stories. The people come from all over to end up in Atlanta. And some of the stories in Fables are set in the 90s, and the stories in Reconstruction are set more in the early aughts and up into maybe the middle of the aughts. But yeah, they're all set in Atlanta and Georgia, and features people that are sort of based on not necessarily specific people, but just character types that I've met and experiences that I've had. And there's quite a few. If you are familiar with Atlanta, you'll
no,
recognize
unfamiliar,
a lot of
unfamiliar. I'm a northerner. New York City.
Okay,
New Yorker.
Okay.
So what
a
I really want
at
was
night.
What I really get clear about the geography, but what I'm really interested in is your creative geography. Even deeper, I mean your process. How does your Georgia roots affect your creative process, I guess? Because
yeah,
I really
well,
get your I get your geographic and all that, but the mental geographic.
Well, it's Southerners are really great storytellers, and
that's
you
true.
Pretty much can't talk to anybody without getting a story from them.
Man,
and
you know
I've
it.
Grown up. Yeah, I've been fortunate to grow up around a lot of people who had stuff to say and weren't afraid to say it, and I've taken some inspiration from them, and also I've been guided by writers like Flannery O'Connor, who's a great
uh-huh.
short stories artist, and William Faulkner.
Yeah.
And also other in college, for instance, I was reading a lot of Harry Cruse, and his work gave me an opportunity to sort of get to know my father a little better, because Harry Cruse also grew up in Georgia in about the same places that my father did. So whenever I'd read about something, in his work, I'd get a chance to ask my father about it. And you know, it gave me a little insight into the world my father grew up in. My father is from middle and south Georgia.
Hmm.
And
even more, I'm thinking, what about technique? Who you as an individual, as a writer? How do you? Since I haven't read your work yet, I look forward to reading it. How do you derive your techniques? And I know you're also a playwright, so that's something different too.
Yeah. My background is I know that it definitely influences the way that I write. And it kind of gives me the fuel to sort of want to write in a way, because I definitely feel like I hear these characters talking to me, and I just have to get it down on some kind of paper or.
What I wanted to hear you say. Okay.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, I have these. People wonder why I write about the people that I do. These are the people that are screaming at me, telling me to get their stories out there. So that's what I.
So that's what's living in your head, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So
definitely.
I'm going to buy your book because I want to read. That's
and we
what
and with that,
saying.
Helen, we have to move on because we have
yes.
other questions here for our guests.
Go.
And,
that's very interesting, Mr. Lupo. I'm going
yes,
to buy
yes,
your book.
I hope. I hope you do, and I hope you enjoy it. And if you ever run into me, I'll be happy to sign it for you.
There you
go. Thank you.
Thanks for calling,
Dr. Helen.
Okay.
Yeah, Jim.
Right, before
go ahead.
We move on, Stephen, I see on here, I don't know if you got to this, but Robert Willis, yeah, he asked a question. You can answer this for other people who might be wondering the same thing. What is the suggested length of submissions for the Fresh Ink Group short story book?
Robert, in the first anthology, we had 54 stories, and it was a 300-something page book. I think we had a couple that were down to like maybe 800 or 900 words, 1,000, 1,200 words, in that kind of range. And then we had one or two that I think hit up close to around 10,000. I think you get too much past 10 or 15,000, you run the risk of one story taking up a lot of the book rather than us being able to fit in a bunch of different voices from different people. So I'd say, 800 words to maybe 10,000, but we're flexible. If you've got something, we'll have a look at it.
I try to go 2,500 to 3,500 on those kind of short stories. I think that's the fair middle ground.
Yeah. Okay. GM, why don't you tell us briefly, about your education, your career, kind of work up to what you're doing now?
Okay, well, I was I got my undergraduate degree at Georgia State University, and for my graduate degree, I went to NYU, and it was quite a challenge getting there. Had the first application I sent them got lost in the mail, and they got all the supporting materials, but not the application packet. So then I resubmitted and got them the application and all, and I was accepted, and went up there and wasn't quite ready to get started. So I had to take another, another semester or so off, and finally got started. Finally, on the third try, I got up there and got into school and found some way to pay for it. It wasn't cheap, and it wasn't particularly easy, but it was a lot of fun. It was the first time I'd ever lived away from home, and that was an experience. And was up there for about 5 years. I was at grad school, so the grad school was only about 2 years, but then I stayed up there for another 3 years. And came back to Atlanta just in time for the Olympics. And after a couple of fits and starts in the job market, I ended up going to work for a contracting firm working at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And I managed to stay there for about 20 years working under three different companies. I like to say that I stayed at the same desk and the company changed around me the whole time. I was there doing computer support for them. I worked for a group called the Orkan Group, which I think came from up around Washington somewhere, Washington, D.C. And then I went to work for TRW, not the credit agency, but the consulting group or the computer consulting group. And then sometime around 2002 or 2003, TRW merged with Northrop Grumman, so I went to work for them, and I stayed with them until about 2017, when they didn't have any work for me anymore. And since then, I've just been kind of picking up jobs as I can, and I worked another maybe 8 or 10 months for the CDC, and then this past year, I've been working on a contract under the state of Georgia for the state of Georgia, helping them out with the elections.
And you were right in the middle of it in a Georgia election. I assume you did the runoff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, the county where I was working was one of the ones that had a special election early on. They were one of the first counties to have an election because their state representative died and had to be replaced. And so they had to have the election, their first election in January. So I worked from January to January with a few breaks in here and there. When everything closed down because of the quarantine, I was out of work from maybe mid-March up until the end of April. And then went back to work for what should have been the May election, but it was ended up being in June. And then I was out of work for another. I wasn't out of work. I was still employed, but there wasn't any work for me until maybe the end of July when I worked for a few days. And then from then on, I was there until the end of the year and then into the runoff.
Now, you also did some work with the Atlanta JCs, I understand. What was that like?
That is correct. I was a member of the Atlanta JCs in the mid-90s, and I served as their membership VP during the Olympics, and I was elected president the following year from 97 to 98. And we did a lot of work, did a lot of projects around Atlanta and got to know a lot of people. And I was, the end of my year, I was recognized as one of the top local presidents in the state. And that's one of my three proudest accomplishments.
All right. When you were at the CDC, you don't recall like ever dropping a glass vial or anything, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't work in that. I didn't have anything to do with that. They didn't let me get anywhere near any of that stuff. I was.
Well, I was going to ask
although
about.
I did work.
I was going to ask about since CDC, Atlanta, The Walking Dead. What's going on with the zombie apocalypse?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I was there at the time they did that. Where somebody in fact they crashed the servers, I believe, because so many people were hitting it. yeah, that was an interesting experience there. But I wasn't really part of most of that. Most of what I did, they had a secure network for people who logged on to transmit data. And I supported that. I helped them get set up with certificates and helped them navigate the system. I was basically user support.
So okay. You had a singing gig one time too, didn't you?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did. Back in high school, I was given the opportunity. I was in chorus my sophomore through senior year, and I believe it was senior year, I had the opportunity to perform with a choral group with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra that was directed by Robert Shaw, the director of the Atlanta Symphony.
Wow.
And that was a lot of fun.
Atlanta's known for having one of the greatest symphonies in the country. There's no doubt.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. It was a thrill being able to do that. Go down there and work out. We didn't actually work with him. We worked with him. He came in for the final rehearsal and worked with us. But you know, it was hey, I'll take it.
Oh yeah, definitely. So yeah. Beam, you want to run another commercial, and then we'll talk to GM some more about his hobbies and interests and what
sure.
Next.
And this happens to be a coincidence, but we're going to run an ad for our caller's book, Dr. Helen's book, American Agony.
Managing pain with opioids is a science. Except politics, money, and overzealous law enforcement are denying American patients the relief they so desperately need. Demonizing the best pain reliever we have leads to needless suffering, even suicides, and it drives the rise in deadly street drugs. Helen Burrell gathers and presents the evidence, the intimidation, the raids of clinics, the chilling effect on those very professionals we trust to care for our loved ones and ourselves. She looks hard at the Veterans Administration, Drug Enforcement Agency, Department of Justice, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Chapters include The Suboxone Hoax, The Wrong Arms of the Law, and The Epidemic of Death. Now in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats, American Agony is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group. Read American Agony now, or you might be the next one hurt.
Yeah, I've read that book, and I'll tell you, it's a real eye-opener. What's really going on.
Yeah, right now it's Fresh Ink Group's best-selling book, so we like to keep people spreading the word. It's a very popular and very, very poignant subject in our times.
Now, GM, when I was reading your bio at the top of the show, I mentioned that you're a member of the Independent Book Publishers Association. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I have recently joined, so I haven't delved as much into it yet as I could have, but I wanted to get involved. I mean, it looked like they had a lot of opportunities and some discounts for services that I use. For instance, I'm set up, my book titles are all set up through Ingram, and I believe they offer some discounts for some of the services they offer there. And they offer some special rates for NetGalley, and I wanted to check those out and just take advantage of that. And I'm probably going to be delving into it a little more in the future to find out, you know, exactly what all they have going. And take advantage of some of the discounts that they offer.
So what kind of reading do you like to do?
I like a little of everything. I mean, I like fiction. I really like to get lost in a book. For instance, maybe a year or so ago, I was reading Infinite Jest by, and of course, I'm going to blank on his name, David Foster Wallace. And that was a huge book. That was like, I want to say it was somewhere about 1,000 to 1,200 pages. And a good chunk of that was footnotes, believe it or not, in a fiction book. And it was one of the funniest things I have ever read. It was hilarious. And I really enjoyed that. Toward the end of 2017, while I was still looking for work, I pretty much read the entire Dark Tower series by Stephen King and quite a bit of other works by him. I just like really long works that kind of delve into things and get into a lot of sort of twists and turns. And I also like true crime books. One of my favorite reads is a true crime book. Something, not just true crime books, but historical books as well. Things that tell you kind of the story behind the story, or taking something familiar and sort of telling how it came about. And those types of books have also had an effect on me because it's caused me to look. When I'm putting together a fictional reality, it causes me to sort of delve deeper into it to sort of find out kind of the nuances of it, the little twists and turns, and ways to tell the story to keep the reader's interest.
Kind of researching the background, are you saying?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, something like that. I would say that is an accurate statement. Yes,
that's one of my favorite parts of writing is the research, because you learn so much.
Yeah.
Things that you didn't know.
Yeah. I like having a complete reference library at my fingertips on the internet. So I make use of that.
Yeah, back in the day, it was called Harlan Hatcher Graduate Library, and it was a bit of a walk to get to it. What a world change. So genealogy is an interest, too. You'd like to read on that?
Yes, I have researched my family's history back to about the 1500s. And different lines, I have different, I can go back a little further, and I can go back reasonably far on both my mother's and my father's side. Some of the other lines are a little hazier. I'm finding that back during the colonial times, it is almost impossible to find anything about women. Nine times out of 10, the person, if a woman is mentioned in a will, she's mentioned as my loving wife without a name. And unless you just happen to find some place where she got a dowry, you almost don't even know what her first name is, let alone her family name.
I still research my family on ancestry.com, and on my father's side kind of ran into that going back just to my great grandparents, and there's like a brick wall and then there's nothing past that, and I'm talking 3 or 4 years now of constantly digging through there and still can't find anything outside of that. But on my mother's side of the family, we go back to like my 13th great grandparents, a couple of branches that go that far back. And I'm finding names of the women this guy had married this woman through the marriage licenses or through church records and whatnot. But you're not getting a whole history of what the women did or didn't do or whatever.
Yeah. With my family, they were here in the colonies and the states fairly early, and you're lucky if they happen to be in one of the larger counties or one of the more one of the better counties. At least one group of ancestors lived in what's called the burned out counties in Virginia, which, you know, the courthouse is burned down and there's nothing left. And, but fortunately, a lot of them came from one of the counties that still has records existing. And that's how I managed to find out so much about them. But, it's a challenge because, People didn't keep records. People's names changed. Spelling wasn't standardized until probably the colonial times.
I've seen multiple spellings of the same person's name all the way through there, but you know it's the same person because you can see the dates and the marriages and things
right.
like that. And, but it's three or four different spellings.
Well, that's what helped me a lot getting because there's one of the things in my family is. They tend to like the same names. And there were for instance, for several generations in my family, the sons were named either Philip or James and Philip. Philip had sons, James and Philip. James had sons, Philip and James. And then every now and then a William would come in or a John or a James or in one instance, there were two brothers who had sons, both named Philip, who were born within a year of each other. And that makes for a lot of confusion trying to sort out who's who and where they went. And what I found helpful for me was just creating timelines where I just wrote down every item I could find on somebody. And that helped sort of clarify who someone was and where they were and when they were supposed to be there. And it helped clear up a lot of confusion.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of there's a narrative in the movie Goodfellas where Karen Hill is talking about meeting these gangsters' families for the first time, and all of their sons' names were Tony or Anthony, and all of the daughters were Marie.
Yeah.
There's Marie. That's Tony over there. Hey, Anthony. There's Tony. Anthony. It's like, just the two names.
So among all of these interests of yours, GM, theater has really struck your fancy. You're interested in theater?
Yes. I have been starting, I guess, around 2008. I wanted to get more involved in the creative community in Atlanta. So I started taking improv classes and going to places like Dad's Garage and Relapse Theater to see improv, and I started taking classes and I started going to shows around town and started going to theatrical shows as well. And for a while I had a reputation as being the guy who sees everything, and that's not too much of an exaggeration because I was going to, there were people holding shows in basements, there were people holding shows in warehouses, people holding shows in you name it. I've been there, and I saw a lot of interesting theater. And I also got involved with Sketchworks, which was a sketch group. And that's where I first started writing scripted material. I was starting writing comedy sketches. And that grew into wanting to write short plays and then longer plays. And the play that I had at Essential, Another Mother, was actually a sequel to a play that I'd worked on starting in around 2011 called Rebecca 2, which I later turned into a novel. And Rebecca 2 has never been produced anywhere, and the sequel to it, Another Mother, was produced fairly early in its life cycle, so I was happy about that. But yeah, I've been writing plays since probably consistently since about 2011, and I had a short play in Merely Writers Presents or Merely Players Presents. Produced a short play of mine in May of 2019, and the Academy Theater in Hapeville, Georgia, produced a short play of mine, June of 2018, I believe. Those are the most recent, those are my most recent ones. I had some stuff that I submitted in Sketchworks. I actually was going to do one of my comedy sketches, but the show got canceled because of the quarantine. And I also submitted some stuff to the to Merely Players Presents again, and they did a show in 2019 called Amplifest, and I had a play in that, and then they were going to repeat that again in 2020, but that didn't happen because of the quarantine. But I did have a bunch of stuff that I submitted to them, so I don't know what they. I don't think they quite got to the point where they made any decisions on what they were going to use or not. So I don't know what would have gotten into that, but I'm pretty sure something of mine would have been in that, but it didn't happen.
Now you also get into photography, and I bring this up because I've seen some of your work, and there's some really cool shots that you have in there. Is this something that you do as a hobby, or is this something that's a little more serious than that?
It's mainly a hobby right now, but I would like to maybe expand on it and see if I could make any kind of living at it. I have a friend who's a photographer, and he's retired, and so he does photography full time now, and he goes around to different shows and sell his work and all. And I'm not sure I want to spend that much time on the road. although that was something I was looking at trying to do with my writing. There are opportunities that come along to set up a booth or to set up a table in different venues around the region and sell books. And I was looking at maybe doing something like that, but again, it got curtailed because of the quarantine. But I've had an idea to maybe try to sell some prints or something. I've gotten a decent photo printer here now that will let me print large format up to about like 11x14s, and I've been doing prints of some photos that have some of my favorite photos and putting them in frames and hanging them up around here. But yeah, it's something I wouldn't mind doing. I'm working on trying to get some coffee cups together. I've got a design for a coffee cup that's got coffee beans and the word coffee on it. So I'm trying to come out with a design for those. I actually have one that's a prototype. It's the only one that exists that I made up. I think it was through Wolf Camera a few years ago when they had their online shop. I got some stuff through them, but I never followed through on it to try to market them. So I may go back and now that I've got some time on my hands, I may go back and see if I can't resurrect that project. So you might be seeing some coffee cups coming down the pike from me in the near future, and maybe some other things.
Well, the one thing we haven't clarified yet for our listeners is, what do you photograph? I mean, it's the subjects that you choose that really, really attracted my attention and got me to want to learn more about you.
I take lots of shots of architecture. I like to take shots of landscapes and outdoor scenes. I got a lot of stuff. I used to walk in at Stone Mountain a lot when I was still in the Atlanta area. I would walk at Stone Mountain, and I'd always have my iPhone with me and take photos from that. I have a Nikon digital SLR that I have used in the past. I got that around 2008, 2009, and so I took a lot of photos at shows, music shows that I attended. I've got like maybe a terabyte and a half of photos from that, from those days. But I take pictures of landscapes. I take pictures of buildings. I take pictures of items that I find discarded along the road as I'm out walking.
Hoodies?
I'm sorry?
Hoodies? Hoodies?
Oh, yeah.
Hoodies?
Yeah. There was a trail that I would go to in Mason Mill Park, and one morning somebody had left a hoodie sitting on one of the benches, and I took a picture of it as a discarded item. And when I came back, it had moved, and so I took a picture of that and published a dual discarded items. And then there was another one exactly like it showed up. And then for several days, after nearly a month afterwards, that hoodie would just move all over the place. I would, it started out on a bench about halfway down the trail, and then it ended up hanging on a sign. And then it started moving toward the entrance of the trail. And then one day it was hanging on the trail sign, so it looked like it was moving out of the park or moving off the trail, and then suddenly it was back again, and I started referring to it as the devil's hoodie because it just seemed to move around on its own.
And, well, there's a story right there.
Yeah, or a book title.
Well, I've got it posted at my blog. I have it posted at my blog as Discarded Purple Madness. There's a photo essay, and I've also got a little video that I took of it, narrated. It's called Discarded Purple. If you go and search at gmlupo.com, you should be able to find it. I think it was in 2017,
2018. Well,
I started to say, when the feature film comes out, the hoodie will be played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
How about we play another commercial here, and then we on the other side of the commercial, we start talking about some of your books.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sounds good to me.
All right.
In Daedalus, Navy SEAL Derek Tiger Bailey, irreverent member of the SEAL's Winged Insertion Command, makes a harrowing first base jump in the experimental Griffin 7 hard-shell wingsuit from the edge of space. He test flies the armor-plated Griffin 10 in Daedalus LEO, catapulting into space by slingshot and dropping from a record-obliterating 160 clicks. Testing the enhanced Griffin 10 MK4 in Daedalus Squad, Bailey's six-man team believes it is fully prepared for hurtling around the world and staging critical re-entry, but challenged to innovate life-or-death solutions with only seconds to spare. It might not survive intact. Then the presidential frontrunner is seized by pirates for ransom in Daedalus combat, and the SWIC team is called to action, where it must literally improvise on the fly with everything to lose. Join Tiger Bailey through all four adventures in sci-fi master Robert G. Willis-Croft's Daedalus series, now collected for the first time as the Daedalus Files, SEAL's Winged Insertion Command, SWIC.
All right. Okay, so that's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and every other online book dealer. So, and these are well-written books, too, so get out and get yourself a copy.
Yeah, they're available individually, or there's an omnibus that's got all of them collected in one called the Daedalus Files. So if you want to get them all at once, that's the economical way to do it. Excellent science fiction from a science fiction master.
All right. So how about we start discussing some of Mr. GM Lupo's books? Let's go with the Fables of the New South. Tell us a little bit about this one here.
Well, Fables of the New South came about in part due to the Essential Theater Festival. They were giving the folks who were participating, they have like a table where they had plays and other works by the artists, by the playwrights. And I wanted something to I wanted something to sell there, basically. And I'd come out with a collection of stories called Freedom and Consequence. So I took several of the stories that were Atlanta-based and updated them. And then I wrote two kind of novelettes to bookmark, sort of bookend the volume. One was called Mockingbird, which was a piece about three individuals in Atlanta that initially started out as a short story based on the myth of Echo and Narcissus. And it ended with a work called Phoenix, which at first it's not necessarily apparent, but it kind of calls back to one of the characters from Mockingbird. And those two stories, those two, the longest of the two stories, I wrote in about 2 months. And then I had some other stories that were more or less character sketches that I'd put out on my blog that I completed and filled out to become stories in order to fill it out with eight stories. So it's a volume of eight stories concerned with people in Atlanta. And the first edition I actually refer to as the festival edition, because that's why I put it together in time for it to be ready for the festival. And anyone who has that certainly has a collector's item, because it's changed a bit since then. The stories are still there, and what happens in the story still happens, but I've rearranged them and made some changes to them in the intervening time. But it was just based on my experiences growing up around Atlanta. And Mockingbird takes place roughly between 1996 and 2000, and Phoenix takes place in Middle Georgia, where not far from where I am now, in the late 80s and in the late 80s, basically up until about 89. And then in between there's several other stories, and there's a couple stories. One's called Journey from Night, and another one's called Atomic Punk, and they both are also loosely related to those two stories. There, they feature characters.
Atomic Punk, great Van Halen song.
yeah, that's where he got it from.
So then those stories, or more specifically those characters and their situations, are what you carried over into Reconstruction, the book that Dr. Helen asked about?
Yes, that is correct. Reconstruction is a continuation of that, of those characters. And it also brings in some folks from Rebecca 2 as well. Fables of the New South was initially just, in fact, one story, Phoenix, was actually written, or I should say outlined, while I was walking one morning at Stone Mountain. I came up with the entire plot of that one morning at Stone Mountain while I was walking. The character in it was in an early version of the play Rebecca 2, and I didn't have any kind of backstory on her. And so one morning when I was getting ready to hit the trail over at Stone Mountain, I tasked myself with coming up with her backstory, essentially, and that's what I came up with. So when you read Phoenix, most of what you read in Phoenix was mapped out on that one morning when I was out at Stone Mountain taking a walk. And as I sat down to write it, there were a few rough patches that I had to kind of get through, because I wanted to probably write more than I should have. And once I got past those, I pretty much had the entire story in my head already. Mockingbird was a bit more organic, in that I wasn't, as I was writing, I wasn't necessarily sure what comes next. And it kind of took shape as it went along. That's kind of one of the ways that I write. I just start writing something, and sometimes I start in the middle and and work my way out. And sometimes I start with, you know, this story, and then that leads to this story, and before long I've got something longer. So I have a different process for each one that I come up with.
Okay, your two books called Worthy and Words, Words, Words. Are both of those out now? They're both for sale?
Worthy is not. Worthy is my work in progress, but I do have the novel form of Rebecca 2, which is available, and it features characters that find their way into Reconstruction as well. Reconstruction is a bit more of a fluid narrative. It's individual stories, but there's kind of a narrative thread that goes through it. Words, Words, Words. I have several smaller volumes. I have a volume of stories called Freedom and Consequence, some of which made it into Fables of the New South. And then I have an essay collection called The Cheese Toast Project and another one called Killing Babies. And I folded those. I took all three of those, the three shorter works. They're really short, not more than about 100 pages each. And I wanted something longer, so I combined all of those into one volume, and that's what Words is. Words, Words, Words. Is and then I also took some of my poetry. I did an ebook with poetry that's called Faces in the Crowd, and I took some of the poems from that and put those into Words, Words, Words as well. So the Words, Words, Words are poetry, essay, and stories. So
yeah, now people can find samples of a lot of this plus a lot of your photographs on your blog. How do they find your blog?
My blog is at gmlupo, that's LUPO.com. And they can go there and find, and I make it easy for a lot of them because I have at the top several subheaders. There's a subheader that you can click on and see my books that are available. You can click on another one and see some of the essays. I think I have one that was set up for Fables of the New South. I don't know if that's currently active or not, but yeah, you can go there and look up. If you just, you know, search on something, you can find it. And I've had the blog online since about 2014. I wanted to give myself more practice writing.
Is that what you call Raised by Wolves?
Yes. Yes. Okay. My blog is Raised by Wolves. Because that's me. I was raised by wolves.
Yeah. Does that have anything to do with Lupo?
Lupo is the Italian word for wolf.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you have a YouTube channel also, right?
I was going to point that out.
Yes, I have a YouTube channel. You can find that at GMATT63, GMAT63.
All right.
My name, incidentally, doing my genealogy, I've discovered that my ancestors were Sephardic Jews of Spanish or Portuguese lineage, and they identified with the tribe of Benjamin. And in Genesis, Benjamin is identified as a ravenous wolf, and that's probably where my ancestors got their name from.
Okay, and then finally, you had a run-in with Elton John one time.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's one of my infamous stories. I was at around Christmas time one year, maybe in the mid-aughts, sometime around 2005, 2006. I was at Tower Records at Lenox, and I'm just walking along, and I look up, and there's Elton John, you know, buying some stuff, and. When I was a kid in the 70s, I mean, he was my favorite artist. He was one of the first rock artists that I listened to. And so, I mean, his music's always been really meaningful to me. And so as soon as I saw him, I just made a beeline for him. And when I was maybe a foot away from him, I just went, "Elton John!" And it scared the hell out of him. He got away from me as quickly as he possibly could. And he had somebody with him. I don't know if it was his manager or his whatever, but it was an older guy, and he kind of got between the two of us and sort of, you know, made sure I didn't get any closer. My brother was actually at Tower Records with me, and he swears to this day that he did not see Elton John anywhere. So,
wow.
But yeah, I stood there for a few minutes and kind of sort of going, you know, saying, "Hey, it's you, it's you." And then it suddenly, you know, I realized, you know, maybe I should leave. And so I went way back into the back of the store, and he got away, and I'm sure he was happy for that. So, but yeah, that was my run-in with Elton John.
You know, I've seen the great documentary on Tower Records, the history, the rise and the decline and the disappearance of Tower Records. Great documentary, and Elton John is plays a big role in it, because when he first came to America, and when he first moved here, he lived right around the corner from Tower Records. And he said he was in there all the time. He would spend thousands of dollars a month buying music. And he still has all these huge album collections because he spent so much time in there. And so there's no doubt you probably did run into him, despite what your brother said.
Yeah. Well, he lives in Buckhead. So he lives right around. He literally lives right around the corner from Lenox Square, I believe.
Yeah, I read that.
I live.
Five countries he's got houses, including Atlanta.
But I lived in New York. When I lived in New York, I used to run into people all the time that I would see on television. It was like, oh, wow, look, who's this? And I never once tried to approach anyone. And then, you know, I get down here and then run into Elton John and make a fool out of myself. So, but I think if it had been Mick Jagger, I would have been okay. But Elton John, that's just, you know. He was one of my favorites, so he's always been one of my favorites.
Well, GM, we appreciate you coming by today. We really appreciate you bringing those corn fritters, those Georgia-style corn fritters that we're snacking on right now. It was good having you, learning about your books, and obviously we want people to go out and find out more about you, buy your books, and if they want to get a message to you and can't find any other way, the contact form at freshinkgroup.com. We'll make sure that you get those messages. We also want our tweeters today. We want to thank Dr. Helen for calling in. And Beam, who do we have next week?
Next week we have author Karen Ingalls. And I've interviewed her before on my old show. And she's a wonderful human being. She's a fantastic writer. And she's got an amazing story. She's a cancer survivor. And she's written a memoir on her battle with cancer, but she's also written some novels as well. So you'll definitely want to tune in and catch this this wonderful woman.
And right now she's writing a book about a program for autistic children down there in Florida, which is really fascinating. And it's almost ready to go. We're going to be publishing that one soon, so we'll make sure we ask her about that too.
And don't forget to, if you missed this show or any other episode, or you just want to listen to it again, find us in the archives. You can find us on YouTube at Fresh Ink Group. You can find us at beamweeks.com. You can find us on stephengees.com. And usually you can find us at freshinkgroup.com. But that, as Stephen said at the top of the hour, you know, we're doing some work on it right now. So, but you can also find us on Spotify. Just go to Spotify and type in Voice of Indie, and you'll have access to all of them.
Thanks again, listeners. We appreciate you spreading the word, helping us build our audience a little bit more each week. And thank you again, GM, for stopping by. It was a real pleasure learning more about you.
Thanks, GM.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks and with that, we will see you all again next week, and take care, everybody. Those of you who are in the cold areas, stay warm.
Stay warm.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com, and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.